Have you ever entered into your child's new reality, the video game? Games now allow you to create entire worlds and the free will to act within them. The question remains, who sets the rules? On Sunday night, tonight, following on from Compass on ABC TV, we're going to have a conversation on the path to ultimate reality, playing God. It's good to welcome into our Melbourne studios one of the stars of tonight's show on Compass, Harry Lee, a game developer with Wonderlands, an independent studio in Melbourne. Harry, good to have you with us.
Thanks so much for having me, John.
In our Adelaide studios, we're joined by Elizabeth Hansley, President of the Australian Council on Children and the Media. Elizabeth, lovely to have you.
Good evening, John. Evening, listeners.
And here with us in Sydney, Dr. Michael Kosamovic, lecturer in ecology and evolution at the University of New South Wales, and he also runs the website The Evolved Gamer. Michael, let me ask you first. Mm-hmm. Games are evolving at an amazing speed.
Absolutely.
Rapidity. I mean, we've gone from games which are just about sort of pointing little dots around squares and obstacles now to sort of metaphysical constructs.
It's impressive, isn't it?
Give us some idea of how rapidly this is happening and what's required in terms of computing power. Just to ask some dumb questions.
Well, it is amazing because I grew up with games. I grew up with the Atari 2600, and really that was just a few colored pixels on a screen.
And Pac-Man and Space Invaders.
Exactly. And Pong, which started it all, really. And now we've got, in my lifespan, almost 40 years, it seems, that we've got some massive changes in how games just play and what they allow you to do. But it's just really in the last decade, which is, it's just changed so much. And people are just being extremely creative. And that's what I think what's driving a lot of these changes.
It's driven by computing power, but it's also driven by people who have ideas about the capacity of what computers can do. That is, they're beginning to ask lateral questions rather than straight questions that go along a straight trajectory. I've got this much power, how many cars can I crash? That's the lateral stuff that's really interesting.
It is amazing that, like I said, it's all these really creative individuals that are just pushing the boundaries and the neat little ideas that they've brought in and that are just shifting how games play and shifting how people are creating games, which is just, like I said, absolutely incredible.
Harry Lee, let's bring you into the conversation here because you're one of those participating in tonight's program, which particularly began to deal with the question of what games are now able to provide us with, that is, moral universes that we can actually act in. Just give us some idea of the sort of range of stuff we can now do.
I mean, the breadth and depth of games that are being produced now is quite incredible. Because the barrier to entry is so low, we're seeing creators from all different walks of life, from different backgrounds. And that diversity and inclusion of a medium is really important because it leads to new experiences. So in addition to games that would have made mainstream press like World of Warcraft or Pokemon or Call of Duty, we're now seeing independent game designers creating things that are personal stories or modes of expression. They're creating things that are meaningful to them. And as games become easier and easier to make, kind of like writing or taking a photograph, I think they're going to have even more relevance to everyday life.
It seems to me the thing that's different about this new era of games is the level of interactive control they allow the player. That is, the player almost, in some ways, seems to be able to take the place of the developer in the way the game unfolds.
Yeah, there are a number of games where that is almost very literally true. Game engines are very playful nowadays. So games like Minecraft, people have created incredible constructions inside that game. It's almost like an engine in and of itself.
Elizabeth Handley, let me bring you in here. One of the things that people tend to express when you see games going to this level where it's not just about a game you play to exercise your skill, but a game in which you are exercising and hopefully in some ways creating moral universes, that there seems to be a sense of, in some areas of sort of moral panic about games. Oh, my goodness, these games are going to do dreadful things to our children. Help.
There might well be people who think that, but there are also people who are keeping a close eye on all developments in children's lives, including those in the media, and just seeing how children interact with the media that they're using and what kind of influence that can have on the children's brain development, their cognitive development, their social development. It doesn't have to be a panic, but a lot of people are just keeping an eye on it and trying to see if there's any way that we can use the various levers that we've got in our society, be they legal policy levers, other kinds of levers, to try to move things in a direction that's going to be beneficial for children and minimise any kind of harm to them.
Haven't we seen this with the introduction of every new form of technology over the past 100 years, whether it's been the movies and then television and now video games?
Well, the word that I'd like to pick up on in your question is this. I'm not quite sure we're talking about the same thing. Yeah. Because, you know, I've already said, you know, I don't think there is a panic, or that there may well be some people who are panicking, and there are some people who just don't like change, be it technological change, social change, change in social mores or whatever. And yes, you know, we do hear this often, you know, when people are asking me from the point of view of Australian Council on Children and the media, what the position is on this kind of thing. And I am often asked, you know, are you panicking? And I'm most determinedly not panicking. I'm just talking about children's well-being and what the research evidence is about what kinds of media experiences are beneficial for children and which might be detrimental.
I'm reminded that this very discussion, this sort of discussion, took place over 150 years ago with the beginning of the rise in popularity of the novel. And many churches and other well-meaning individuals in society suggested that people should not be allowed to read novels, as they allowed people to create their own moral worlds instead of getting them out of the authorised texts, such as the Bible. Is this part of what's going on here, Harry?
I think that any backlash is to be expected with the rise of a new generation of technology and media. And with video games in particular, because it was industrialized so quickly and because it was contingent on technological advancement for so long, there was not yet an opportunity, perhaps, to introduce the mainstream public to the artistic side of the medium or what could be achieved. And even as I say that, you know, the word medium is really difficult to apply here because games span such a huge body and corpus of work, right? It's not just one particular thing. It would be akin to comparing YouTube videos to TV to film and cinema and saying they're all the same thing.
Well, let's take an example. And Michael, let's bring you in here. The classic example cited by people who say that, look, game developers set up a set of rules within which a game is played, and those rules construct a moral universe, and people learn the rules of that moral universe and play in that moral universe. The classic one that's always mentioned is Grand Theft Auto, where it seems that everything depends on you taking an action which, according to the basic rules of the game, potentially sets up conflict and can be resolved by conflict or through conflict.
So these kinds of open world games are an interesting thing because people can be in whoever they want when they play and they can do almost whatever they want. And games like Grand Theft Auto are interesting because, like I said, they allow people to explore what it is to be human and what it is to, you know, play around and explore an environment.
But the way you get to explore more is by being more and more violent. If you choose in Grand Theft Auto to be a nice person, it's a pretty bland old game.
It probably would. You wouldn't be getting very far in the game if you were just a nice guy. That's very true. They do, but it's just as it's important to explore any kinds of emotion, it's important to explore these kinds of things as well, I think. And having people play these kinds of games and, you know, see some of the violence that's associated with them, and see what can happen in certain scenarios, it's not necessarily a bad thing, because these things are unfortunately happening all over the world all the time. And a game can potentially give an individual a glimpse into the life that other people lead and some of the situations that may push people into certain scenarios within their lives.
But that's not the case with Grand Theft Auto, is it? Because the only... Positive is the wrong word. The only sort of active move you can make is one which involves you in conflict to a greater or lesser degree, and you can go to extreme conflict or a letter. Harry, what's your observation about Grand Theft Auto? It seems to operate within a very defined set of rules.
Yeah, I mean, it's an open-world game, but it is still ultimately a created work. And we can look at it through lens of auteur theory, or we can look at it, you know, in the structural sense that society has asked for this type of product in a consumerist demand sort of thing.
They love it.
But it's not necessarily a reflection of real life, you know. It's a reflection of something, for sure, and I want to be able to dissect that culture that promotes GTA as a positive thing. Personally, I don't very much enjoy it, but I think it's fascinating to look at.
I agree. Yeah, I think it is.
Michael, you actually wrote a piece recently about mods and GTA 5, right?
I did, yeah. It was one of the newer mods that just came out recently.
This is modules that plug into the game.
Well, these are hackers. What they do is they come along and they're able to change some of the code or move around some of the existing code to alter the unintended gameplay, essentially. So in this mod, one could control a character and essentially stick to their backside, and what it looks like is they're performing rape. And, you know, obviously this is a terrible thing. Obviously it's not anywhere near to what is experienced in real life, but it's interesting that individuals have gone out to create this or modify the code in such a way that they were able to do this within the game. And it's interesting to watch people's reactions and see how they respond to these kinds of things, because I think it says something about us, but I don't know exactly what that is either. It's a difficult thing to say.
And it's interesting because you've got two things operating there. You've got the universe established by the game creators, and then someone modifying the game, plugging in a module that enables that to go to an even further stage, that is, heighten that. Elizabeth, what's your observation about these sort of games and the capacity of people to draw up a set of rules which confine you to a certain way of making decisions? That is, you've got to be cruel to advance.
Well, that's something that most people would feel needs to be looked at if it's the kind of game that children are going to be allowed to play. We know that GTA 5 has been rated R18 plus in Australia, but we know that lots of children still get access to R18 plus games, and that there are a lot of parents who will just go out and buy it for their child, either because they don't believe in the classification system or because they think their child is different and that the rules shouldn't apply to them, or for whatever reason. But there are quite a few articles out there by gamers who work in game shops saying, I'm just horrified that there are so many parents just buying this material for their children.
And what about the way in which classification works? We can say GTA 5 gets the equivalent of an R certificate when you go to the movies, but of course, as you indicate, parents could go out and buy it and give to their kids, and
that's
then you
right.
add this added dimension that Michael's already illustrated of mods being able to plug into the game, which elevate that level even further.
Well, yeah, that's right. And, I'm the last person to ask what one might do about that, other than to give parents the information, which is what the Australian Council on Children and the Media tries to do. We do our best to get the information out there to parents and support them in making the best decisions for their children. But there's only so much that one can do, unfortunately.
So what's your concern, your principal concern about games? It's not, I take it, the capacity of kids to discern fantasy from reality. It's something else.
No, no, it's not that. The research has come out with three broad areas of concern in relation to the influence that games can have on people. Well, not, shall I say, violent media. I mean, a lot of this research was done on violent media. It's been extrapolated into games, and there's still work being done on whether the interactivity of games shifts things again. But I'll just sort of stick to the long-standing research on violent media. Three broad things. One is desensitization to violence and acceptance of violence as a means of resolving conflict. One is the development of a mean and scary view of the world, that is a tendency to see aggression in other people, even when it's not necessarily there, and even when you're not necessarily aggressive yourself, you just sort of see and expect it in other people. And the third is the much rarer, more individualized one that is has to come along with a variety of other factors in a person's life, but it's a contributing factor to actual violent and aggressive behaviour. Now, nobody is suggesting that everybody who sees a violent movie or plays a violent game rushes out and becomes a serial killer or anything like that, but that it's a factor that can work in with other factors. But look, I've got to tell you, from the point of view of the Australian Council on Children and the Media, that's only quite a small part of the picture. The main one is the desensitisation. And there we are concerned, you know, not just for the child who's playing the game and who may become desensitised to violence, but to the other children that child then has to interact with, be it in the classroom, the playground, on the sports field or whatever. And if there is a child who's become desensitised to violence, that has a potential for an impact on that child's whole community. And we have to think about it in those terms, not just the individualised terms a lot of people talk about it in.
Mm. Michael, a genuine concern?
With violent video games?
Yeah, and desensitization.
Well, with any type of medium, if you're constantly viewing it, there's always the possibility of that. There's been some nice long-term studies done on populations in France and some other countries in Europe where they've looked at, you know, how much gameplay in general, not just necessarily violent gameplay, but gameplay in general, how does it affect school performance and child behavior and things like that. And the studies, we always need more studies, but these studies are showing that they're not having that kind of an effect. That kids are doing quite well when they're playing games at a moderate level. You know, they're doing well at school. They don't have the problem. They don't internalize and externalize the problems that kids who play it for a lot longer do. But the thing here is, it's not just the gameplay, of course. With moderating gameplay comes parents who probably care more, who are spending the time with their kids, who are doing other things with them. So, you know, it is more than just playing a game not playing a game.
Yeah, this whole issue of desensitization is front and center in the media at the moment because of something that we're seeing on the screens every day. And because video games are mediated through screens to us.
Absolutely.
And we're seeing stories of ISIS beheading people. You only have to go on to any one of a number of websites and you can see horrific people.
Absolutely, yep.
Videos of people being killed, children being killed. Desensitization is an area that video in general, leaving aside games, the questions are being asked at what level we begin to take this seriously. Now, currently on television, the ABC is not allowed to show anything that rates above R. We can't do that on the news. So we recognise it about television. But video games are doing some of the same things. Is desensitisation an issue, really? I mean,
you know, I'm by no means an expert on that at all, but I could see it has the potential to be an issue, and anything that we watch too many times has the potential to desensitize us. Mm. But what that means in the long term, I don't know. I don't know the studies well enough to be able to actually say.
Harry, your observation on that?
I would definitely defer to Elizabeth's expertise here, as well as people like Laura Crawford, who's a PhD candidate at Swinburne University, looking at screen violence and culture. Or Helen Berentz, who's doing a PhD in Dr. Helen Berentz, who's PhD in peace studies, looked at how war affects children and has written about how video game depiction of children and of war can mediate some of the same feelings. But yeah, I have no personal expertise in that area. I will note, though, you know, you mentioned the R 18-plus rating, Elizabeth, for GTA. Yeah. And that was, I think, like in the end, down to its drug use reference, right?
Yeah.
More than the violence. Yeah, you're right. It's true.
Yes, so, I mean, absolutely. There's still quite a lot of violence allowed at MA 15+, as there always was, and as there is in films as well. And there are some very violent films that have also fit into the MA 15+ category, because as long as the violence is justified in the context, it's not considered to be too strong.
I tell you what I'm actually more worried about than desensitization. It's culture, the inculcation of particular toxic cultures that lead to gamers having a problem in the community. So I'm thinking that, like, yeah, it's very well and good that we talk about violence in games, but sexism, racism, any sort of curiarchal oppressive structure in games goes quite unchecked.
They're big issues,
absolutely,
too. And there's been quite a lot of discussion of those that I've encountered on the web in recent months, and I hope that there'll be a further crystallisation of those thoughts, because they're all, you know, very big issues for children and young people whose views on the world are still developing. And again, you know, if we've recognised that children are often left to play these things on their own and don't have the parental input, then you know, we need to really think about what's in those games and how we as a society can counter those messages at least.
Yes, yeah. I'm surprised that Ajit, and I dare say it'll come from a module somewhere or a modification somewhere, that somebody takes one of the standard games that have the West battling the communist world to the West battling Islamic civilization. I mean, that seems to me that all you need to do is flick a couple of things and off you go.
Well, it's definitely more complicated than flicking a few things, but I agree with Elizabeth and Harry, in the sense that it's not necessarily the games that we should probably worry about. It's the human interaction within the games, on online games. And a lot of the games that kids play nowadays are online with other people, and they're not just playing with other kids. They're often playing with other adults. And that is a difficult thing to moderate, and another problem altogether, I think.
You're on Sunday Night on ABC Radio around Australia through Radio Australia and via the web to the world. We're talking about games, particularly God in games. That is, the capacity for game players now to actually begin to help determine the rules by which the games are played. That is, to create your ultimate reality, to be your own Doctor Who. If you'd like to join the conversation, 1-800, please give us a call on ABC Radio. The number we'll give you in just a moment. We'll make sure that you can call us on, and I'll just give you the number for tonight so that we can make sure it's a standard one. 1-800 1-300-222-702 if you're joining us in Sydney and the rest of Australia tonight. 1-300-222-702. 1-300-222-702. And do give us a call. I wanted to switch the orientation of the conversation now. If you saw Doctor Who tonight, you were seeing something about artificial intelligence beginning to ask big questions. And from our panel guests tonight, who are Dr. Michael Kasimovich, or Kasimovic, rather. Sorry, Michael.
Either one works, don't worry about it.
Elizabeth Handsley and Harry Lee. We're going to push the conversation on towards the wider turf of interactivity. And that is the extent to which the interactivity begins to give us the opportunity to make moral judgments and even ask wider moral questions. Now, Harry, I'd like you to introduce this to us. I was watching some of the games illustrated in God in Games tonight on ABC television, and saw one towards the end of the program in which you can create an avatar which reacts with other avatars other people joining the game, in which together you sort of make a moral world, you make moral choices, and create the universe that you believe is the best of all possible worlds. How sophisticated is this stuff? And what sort of capacity for decision-making are we being given here?
So just to clarify, was the game that you're talking about Journey?
Yeah.
Okay, yeah. So in Journey...
The scenario was... you look at the landscape, it's a bit like a scene out of Dune, but that's where it starts.
It's gorgeous, isn't it?
Yeah.
So that Journey is a game by that game company, and it takes, the central premise is that you are moving towards the mountain, the apotheosis of your journey, and along the way, traversing desert sands, you may or may not meet a stranger, another figure just like you, who is actually another person playing this video game somewhere in the world, and you go on this journey together. And while you're alone, there are many things that you can do to interact with the environment. But when you're together with a person, and as you go through this journey, you start to form a close bond and friendship, and definitely some sort of relationship that is being translated just through simple honking that you can perform in the game, as well as flying around this desolate space.
Where does it take us? What capacity does it give us?
I think that it gives us the feeling of wonder, of childhood wonder, of reconnecting with a soul in a very language-independent way. You know, you don't know who this person is, but by the actions and agency that you have in this world, of drawing love hearts in the sand, or diving after each other, or using each other's voice to carry you into the winds, there is a feeling of being part of something larger than yourself. There's that sense of fellowship. There's a sense of discovery and exploration. So it does, for many people, evoke a spiritual journey, especially because the story structure of the game, or maybe the mood and emotional qualities of the game, evoke a monomyth story.
And I take it that when you're playing this game, if your avatar is there and operating, if you stop playing, your avatar is still acting in the game. Your avatar is still an agent in the game. Or can that be the case? I mean, I take it there are games like that.
There are games like The Sims in which the characters or the objects in the game can act of their own volition according to game code. And they can be moral agents. They can also be, in a network agent theory, their own independent black boxes, and you have no idea how, you know, the inputs and outputs necessarily connect. But with Journey, I think they strived for a sense of immediacy. So, you know, you are there as the avatar and your actions translate directly. So,
Elizabeth, it's got potential for great benefit. There's a positive side here as well as the potential to sort of make wrong decisions. But this capacity to make right decisions has great pluses going along with it. I mean, this games are not all bad here. In fact,
there is an arena here
which can be of enormous potential power and usefulness.
Well, that's right. I have a colleague in the US called Michael Rich, who's the director of the Center on Media and Child Health, and he has a line that I love to borrow, which is to say that all media use is educational. It's just a matter of what it educates children in. So, you know, is it teaching you that stomping on a hooker after you've robbed her is fun, or does it teach you something else? So, you know, games are. You're just as wide open as any other experience for potentially beneficial experiences and potentially problematic experiences and you know, as always, it's a matter of, well, what kind of adult guidance is the child getting, and is that appropriate to the child's age and stage of development? But there's absolutely no doubt that that games can be hugely educational and advantageous to children's development, not to mention fun and entertaining, which is an important part of what children are entitled to in their lives as well.
I gave you a number a moment ago, 1-300-222-702. If you also want to call us nationally on 1-300-800-222, 1-300-800-222, that one will work also, 1-300-800-222 or 1-300-222-702 if you're in the Sydney area. Do join us around Australia. We're talking about games. If you watched God in Games on Compass this evening, and even if you watched Doctor Who, the first episode of the new series, no spoilers, please, we're opening up the areas of technology, asking ultimate questions and leading us perhaps into the worlds of ultimate reality. We'll take your calls in just a couple of moments, but let's ask one or two more questions of our guests in the studio this evening. Harry Lee, game developer with an independent studio in Melbourne. Elizabeth Hansley, president of the Australian Council on Children and the Media. And with us here in the studio, Dr. Michael Kosumovic, lecturer in ecology and evolution at the University of New South Wales, and also runs a website called The Evolved Gamer. Michael, what is a highly evolved gamer these days?
That's a very good question. I'm not even sure I know the answer to that one.
Homo ludus, right?
What was that? Sorry.
Homo ludus?
True enough, I guess, yeah. Yeah, we could go into that. Gamers are a funny sort. They've changed how games play and how games feel just through buying them. They're consumers, as Harry mentioned, and the things that sell, that's what developers create. And they're really, really good at knowing what they like and what they want, and that's why the big developers have really walked this narrow path of what sells games really, really well. And like Harry's mentioned, you know, now that games are more easily made by the average individual, things are starting to change. And this is at where I think things are going to get most fun, when we have a lot more experienced people with a lot more different experiences coming in and making games for everyone and anyone to play. And they could be short, 2-minute little things, but they can teach us a lot about other individuals' perspectives, which I think is the most interesting thing about games.
Elizabeth, photorealism in games is also adding a different dimension. I mentioned earlier that there was a sort of shock and awe, horror almost, in the early 19th century with the arrival of the novel replacing the Bible as the moral code. And here were novels opening up different moral universes in which people acted in ways which were not contrary, not consistent with the established moral order. With video games, and particularly the way in which they are increasingly interactive, and now with 4K television capacity, we're getting a level of photo and immersive realism that is quite extraordinary. Is there much work done on this and its potential impact?
Well, what I can tell you is that from the research that's been done on exposure to violent media in the past, one of the findings was that the influence is heightened when the viewer doesn't get to see the consequences of the violence, which suggests that maybe more realistic scenes that show more of the blood and gore and the results of violence might in fact have a protective effect, which is kind of interesting considering that our classification system wants to classify things more highly or higher up the scale if you see more blood spatters. And in the past, and it may still be going on, but certainly before we adopted the R18 plus classification, there was plenty of evidence of games having been modified to fit into MA 15 plus by the removal of things like blood spatters or the removal of evidence of the consequences of the violence, whereas maybe, according to the research that's been done on non-interactive media anyway, it's actually better if people are seeing that's more of a protective effect, if people
they
are seeing the consequences,
of
the violence. I'm not sure exactly what the psychological process is, but that's what the psychologists have found, as I say, in relation to non-interactive media, and we're still really not quite sure what impact interactivity has, except to say that we know that children and everybody learns better by doing than by watching, and therefore there's good theoretical reasons to think that interactivity heightens whatever influence media exposure might be having.
Harry, I believe there's a game, I haven't seen it, so I don't know, released last year called Beyond two souls, which actually went to the trouble of putting actors in motion capture suits to get their likeness and really give you that immersive, interactive feel at to an extraordinary level. Are you aware of it?
Yeah, so Beyond Two Souls uses motion capture to deliver a performance that seems very human. And actually, one of the first prolific games to do that was made in Australia, L.A. Noir, by Bondi Studios. And I heard that laugh. I know what you're thinking.
Not at all.
I want to be in on it now.
Little secret communications going on.
Yeah, I can tell.
It's a game in and of itself. So I think there has been a push towards fidelity, which I'm going to separate from realism. This idea that we want games to look like real life. And actually, the games that turn out that way aren't necessarily always realistic at all. The more it tries to emulate real life, the more obvious the seams are, the cracks, and the differences. In fact, I think, I can't remember the quote, but it's definitely this idea that stylization of media can highlight the truth better than capturing in a fidelity sense.
That's interesting, yeah. And again, the classification system would say the opposite. It would say if it's stylized, then it has less impact.
Yeah, which, I mean...
Have more.
Yeah, I think the classification system is a good guideline and something that's useful for society in a game theory sense. But when analyzing it from, you know, what does this actually try to say and how much truth is it conveying, things can sometimes only be told through story.
Yeah,
Michael, you were chuckling about some observations Harry made. Do they bear on this immersive reality thing we're talking about here?
Well, there's like Harry mentioned, there's a push to try and make things look real because, you know, maybe we interact with it in a different way. Maybe we appreciate it more for its ability to look more realistic. But there is going to be a certain level where you wouldn't want it to look too realistic. I'm not going to play a game where someone looks exactly like a human being. It's kind of creepy to me and freaky. I prefer stylized games, but that's just a preference. It'll be interesting to see how far that gets pushed. Because if you are playing a first-person shooter and the characters in the game look extremely human and very real, I don't think I'd want to play that kind of game for very long at all, or at all, actually.
Well, let's go to the other end of the spectrum now, the good game spectrum, just for a few moments, because, Harry, one of the things that we've been alluding to, and particularly God in Games tonight alluded to, is this capacity to create moral universes opens up the world of moral choices, and, in fact, where the game isn't governed by the game creator, such as in Grand Theft Auto, in which the game creator biases your actions towards violence being the productive agent of creative results, these new games give you the capacity to actually choose whether or not good actions can lead to good results. But in some ways, is that just as contrived as the bad actions lead to good results? That is, it's a game developer just putting on a different set of criteria as to what leads to success, or are we talking about something that really is quantitatively different?
I don't think
or
this
qualitatively is different, I should say.
Sure. I don't think this is a game-specific question at all. You know, we know that within remediation theory, you know, a game's content might well... How do I best explain this? The idea that books might, for example, have a character that does something which the reader might find immoral to an end that produces a good result. And that book is, it has a morality system embedded inside it. It is creating a value and judgment that the reader is asked to construct and deconstruct in their mind and engage with it. And that's what makes it art. That's what makes it... piece of media. So, you know, it's not the object itself. It's in the act of experiencing it and then translating it to one's own experiences and memories and values.
Elizabeth.
Yeah.
When we're looking at games that give you the capacity to in some way become the governor of the morality of the game, are we seeing here something that is quite qualitatively different from what we've seen before, And again, do you see sort of great opportunities here? And what sort of opportunities do they provide for us? Because we have tended to talk about the negatives.
Yeah, we have. That's right. You know, if it bleeds, it leads. Like everywhere else. Yeah. I was just sitting here nodding my head here in the TARDIS studio in Adelaide as Harry was just talking, because you know that was all making a lot of sense to me. That you know we interact with media, we engage it in our own way or in the best way that we've been taught to do. And, you know, and that's part of what we learn at school. You know, when I studied English, I learned how to read a novel and how to get the most out of it. And, you know, hopefully children these days are learning how to engage with all different forms of media. Though it's interesting to note, last time I looked at the national curriculum for schools, it didn't say anything in there about media literacy at all. So that was kind of interesting. Yeah, I know. I might need to do something about that somehow. But anyway, coming back to your question,
please,
John.
Please, good luck.
Yeah, exactly. Look, you know, once again, I can say there's no doubt that there are positive opportunities for using media to enhance children's experience, to enhance their fun, to enhance their sense of wonder at the world around them, whatever it is that you want children to have that you consider to be beneficial to their development. You know, we can use games and other forms of media to that end. We know that there's been fantastic TV made for kids, for example. And now there's a lot of pressure on the government to remove the structures that have made that TV available to children. Maybe we now need to turn to games and apps and try to get the best out there and help parents to choose the best media for their children. But you know, that doesn't just happen. You know, there have to be resources put behind it, and you know, as both of my co-panelists were saying, good luck with that. In the current environment.
Also, folks, we should put out that if you have a particular bias in your moral universe, then there's probably a game to suit you. You could have games driven by a Buddhist morality. You could have games driven by a Christian morality. You'd have games driven by a sort of as in Grand Theft Auto, a nihilistic morality. I guess, Harry, it's sort of open slather on what sort of universe you choose to enter.
And we've only looked at like this tiny sliver of what's out there, right? And it's the stuff that people tend to focus on. But it would be like judging movies by the works of Michael Bay.
That would be disappointing, wouldn't it?
Wouldn't that just?
Oh, my.
You know, or something like that. And so maybe it's helpful to frame this discussion as, like, any time that you say game, replace it with any other media, you know, in your head, and see whether the sentence sounds silly. Because a lot of this conversation...
I would just add one caveat to that, though, which is the fact that we know that a lot of children, and quite young children, do get deeply, deeply immersed in interactive media. You know, whether it's what you and I might think of as a video game, or you know, these days apps on tablets, and people's phones and so on, and so you can get situations where children just spend hours and hours and hours doing this. Now, you know, that is probably a result of not fantastic parenting. Absolutely, you know, we would all agree with that. But you know, what do we do as a society? You know, can we force the parents to parent better? No, we can't. So can we set things up in such a way as to minimise the impact of that less than desirable parenting? And that's where you start thinking about content, you start thinking about availability, those sorts of things. And that's where, once again, the classification system has a role to play. And other sorts of levers that we have in society have a role to play too.
Let's take some calls. Alf is on the line. Alf, welcome to you. What would you like to ask?
Well, you guys are, thank you very much for the program tonight. You guys are doing some interesting topics. Just obviously with a lot of the games, most of the topics you guys have mentioned, I was probably going to ask for any, but you've covered most of them. But like, especially when you started mentioning about the Beyond Two Souls, which is a game that I played it most recently, and it's a very interesting style of game. The fact that most of the violence in the game is basically if you choose to take that part of the game, but and even if you do end up, you know, choosing the violence part, it sort of ends up coming back basically the same sort of thing anyway. Sort of like as in society these days, that violence is just inevitable. It's never going to leave us.
And do you have a question that flows out of that?
Well, I just thought, well, not really a question or so. This sort of thing. I'm a bit nervous, to be honest. But
that's all right. You're doing well.
Yeah. Just sort of querying parts that I'm all over the place. Look, I'll let you guys continue and find.
All right. Look, we'll take it as a comment, Alf. Thank you very much for joining us on Sunday night. We're taking your calls to talk about games. Steve has a question for us. G'day, Steve. What would you like to say?
G'day. I'm just going to try and. Sorry, I was on speaker. I'm going to show my age here because as I was growing up as a child, we used to run around in groups of mostly boys, playing cowboys and Indians or soldiers, shooting at one another with our toy guns. And as I became older and started parenting, this was, well, extremely frowned upon. Toy guns no longer allowed in schools, rah, rah, rah. And because it encouraged violence. And now I see the circle coming around where children of any age can play games which where the violence is simulated but nevertheless far more graphic and more realistic than we ever envisaged. And the other question was, or maybe a comment, that a lady said that, or maybe a gentleman said that, the more realistic something is, the more impact that has upon the person. Now, that may be taken two ways. It can either encourage them or it can discourage them from violence. Would that be a logical reason to remove the ABC's code on things like beheading and allowing more graphic, close-ups of the beheading, say, of James Foley, so that the impact on children is, to discourage them from doing that sort of thing? Would the ABC come at that?
That's an interesting question because it's a question which has been actually debated in the highest editorial circles of the ABC over recent weeks. So you've asked a question that actually has some topical reality. But Elizabeth, you first.
Yeah, really interesting question. Thank you for that. And I guess I could just bring us back to the dual objectives of our classification system, which are A, to ensure that that adults are able to read, hear and see what they want, and B, that children be protected from material likely to harm or disturb them. And so what we've got there is a sort of a tension between the sort of civil liberties focus of the first one and then the protection of children focus of the second one. Now, there's a third one as well, which is to protect the community from things that are offensive, and that's where we get the morality into it. Now, what we've just been talking about, or what I've just been talking about, has really been the second one. Like, what is harmful to children and what does the research say? Because to me, that is always, it's got to be a scientific question. What is harmful to children? It's not a moral question. It's a scientific question. So there you start looking at things like what I was talking about before, and so you'll say things like, well, the research shows if you're seeing violence, you're less likely to become desensitized to violence if you see the results of the violence. So that's one thing. Now, I would be willing to bet that where the ABC is coming from on all of this is the third thing that I talked about, which is just what is offensive to people, what is going to shock people and make people feel terribly, terribly uncomfortable if they see it. And I think that beheadings would fall into that category, and that's something that just people do not want to see on television and would not like to have foisted upon them on television. And in that context, I would say if you make it more graphic, more close-up, show more detail, you're only compounding the offence. So you might be making it less likely that those people will be desensitised to that kind of violence, but that you're making it a good deal more offensive and shocking for people.
Harry, briefly on that one, or Michael, either of you? Nothing? Well,
I'm good.
Yeah, Harry, are you okay?
I have many, many thoughts, but I'll keep them to myself.
Well, don't give us too many of them because we've just about run out of time.
Yeah.
It goes surprisingly fast on Sunday night. You feel you're just getting to some interesting questions and time runs out. We're going to have to say goodnight at this point to this part of the conversation, but if you'd like to pick it up in a couple of hours' time in the chat room when Jared McKenna joins us, please feel free to do so. But right now, we're going to have to say thank you and and Good Gaming to Harry Lee, game developer at the independent studio in Melbourne, Wonderlands, to Elizabeth Hansley, president of the Australian Council on Children and the Media, and Michael Kusumovic, lecturer in ecology and evolution at the University of New South Wales, who runs the website The Evolved Gamer. And if you wish to catch any of our guests, try their websites.